Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 2nd of September and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 48 in our series here where we look at white contributions to civilization and we look at history through a patriotic lens. And we're still looking at Britain at the moment, but we've moved forward to about 400 AD. And in the next few episodes, we're going to be looking at the Saxons and the various other Germanic tribes and what happened to them on the continent, and also the Saxons in Britain. And of course, as always, I have with me my co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Hi, Sven. I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for having me back. And yeah, looking forward to getting into this. There's a lot of good information, and I don't really know too much about these guys, but they're infamous and a staple of our ancestry.
Yeah, I think it's important that we learn about this. Important from the point of view that it's British history, and it's a glorious history, and it's a very patriotic history. And it's also important that we learn about the origins of these other nations on the continent. And we're going to be using R.W. Morgan again for our main quotes. Of course, he was a very, very well-renowned Welsh historian from, I think it was about 1850, 1860, and he had access to all the Welsh language histories. And we're also going to be using Wikipedia just to flesh out some of the characters that he talks about, and also to show that he's not just making this stuff up. He's getting all his sources from the original classical historians. And we've gone through the time of Britain with the Romans. We've talked about that. And now we're going to move into the area with the Saxons. But we'll have a bit of a look at what's going on at this time on the continent as well to begin with. The Roman Empire west of the Alps fell on December the 31st, AD 406, just before that movement of the nations that is termed in the triads the Black Invasion. And these nations, those ones that were moving, were the Huns, Goths, Vandals, Burgundians, Franks, and Alani. The Huns proceeded from eastern Tartary. The Goths, or the Getae, came from southern Russia. The Vandals, Burgundians, and Alani came from central Germany, and the Franks from western Germany. And I would say that some of those tribes as well, they'd been coming in from Scythia, and then they'd entered into these countries. But then they were just basically moving all around across Europe and on the edges of the Roman Empire. And of course, all these tribes wanted to be a part of the Roman Empire. The southern Germany and northern Italy were conquered by the Ostrogoth, the Ostrict, which is where we get the word Austria from. France was conquered by the Franks, Spain by the Suevi. The Vandals and the Visigoths conquered northern Africa by the Vandals, and Hungary by the Huns. And the Goths, Franks and Vandals had, prior to AD 400, enrolled themselves as stipendiaries of the empire, stipulating in return for large blocks of territory that they would defend the empire's frontiers against all invaders. And the armies of the Roman Empire had in fact been barbarianized. That is, they were recruited almost wholly from non-Roman sources, long before the dissolution of its civil constitution, and some of its most responsible offices were now being discharged by barbarian statesmen. Thus, Stilicho, its most sagacious politician and commander, was a Vandal. So we'll just pause there. As I say, these tribes wanted to be a part of the Roman Empire. So what they said was, we will defend the Roman Empire if you give us land and you allow us access to the Roman resources. Do you want to pick up on any of that, Patriarch?
Yeah, that's interesting, because they were also ransacking Rome, weren't they? So it was like, we'll either invade you or you pay us to protect you. That's how I understand it. Is that what went off?
Yeah, that's what happened. And Rome ended up paying them huge sums of money, basically, not to keep rampaging through Rome. And we will get to those bits. And it also reminds me of later on when you had Charlemagne and Charlemagne was a Christian, and you started to have a Christian Commonwealth. And then you had various tribes and nations that wanted to be a part of that. They wanted to have access to what Charlemagne had and the empire that he had. And it's rather similar to these barbarian tribes wanting a piece of the Roman Empire. In AD 398, Alaric the Goth of the House of Balti applied in his capacity as chief of the Gothic army of defence for the master generalship of the whole empire, the dignity instead being conferred by the emperor Honorius on Stilicho. Alaric, abjuring his allegiance to Rome, invaded Italy, but was with the aid of the British legions defeated by Stilicho with an immense slaughter at Pollentia in Lombardy. Alaric, after a second defeat at Verona, withdrew his forces, who were now reduced to just one third of their number, to the wilds of Germany. So that's these first two attacks on Rome, and it was because Alaric the Goth was not made into a general. Stilicho was. And I guess he would have said, well, Stilicho's a Vandal, I'm a Goth, what's the difference? We're both barbarians. You should have made me into the general. In AD 406, a new inundation under Radagaisus, passing through the Alps, the Po, and the Apennines, besieged Florence, but were overthrown on the hills of Fasciuhi by the Vandal Generalissimo, with the loss of their leader and 140,000 men. So Stilicho the Vandal, he managed to get rid of them. The rest, computed at 250,000, consisting of Suevi, Vandals, Alani, and Burgundians, effected the passage of the Alps, routed the Franks, to whom the defence of the German frontier had been committed, with a loss of 20,000 men, and crossed the Rhine on the 31st of December, AD 46. Mentz was destroyed, Strasbourg, Spires, Reims, Tournai, Arras and Amiens were all plundered and burnt, and the 17 provinces of Gaul to the foot of the Pyrenees succumbed without a second engagement to their arms. So Gaul has been taken over by the Suevi, Vandals, Alani and Burgundians. So you can see how these barbarian tribes, they all got together to take what they wanted.
Yeah, and they were outside the Roman Empire, and I guess that's where barbarian, the term barbarian comes from, because they sounded like they were kind of incoherent, wasn't it?
There was just anyone that wasn't a Roman citizen was considered a barbarian, regardless.
Yeah, uncivilized, basically.
Yeah, they weren't Roman citizens. They were barbarians. But the Romans themselves had become soft. I mean, they were employing these guys to be in their armies.
Well, they got fattened up, didn't they, off the wealth, I guess. And that's what happens when a nation becomes kind of, you know, weak. What's the saying? Weak nations...
Weak times.
Weak men.
Yeah, weak nations do breed weak men. They say good times breed weak men. Weak men make bad times. Bad times make good men to fix them up and set the good times up again.
Yeah, Rome at the end of just after the fattened pig. And then the hardened barbarians are ready to take the spoil.
Yep, and that's exactly what happened. So we'll have a look at what Wikipedia says about Alaric the Goth. Alaric I was the first king of the Visigoths from 395 to 410. He arose to leadership of the Goths, who came to occupy Mosia, a territory acquired a couple of decades earlier by a combined force of Goths and Alans after the Battle of Adrianople. Alaric began his career under the Gothic soldier Gainas and later joined the Roman army. Once an ally of Rome under the Roman Emperor Theodosius, Alaric helped to defeat the Franks and other allies of a would-be Roman usurper. Despite losing many thousands of his men, he received little recognition from Rome and left the Roman army disappointed. After the death of Theodosius and the disintegration of the Roman armies in 395, he is described as the king of the Visigoths. He was a Roman citizen, as only a Roman citizen could obtain the rank of Magister Militum. As the leader of the only effective field force remaining in the Balkans, he sought Roman legitimacy, never quite achieving a position acceptable to himself or to the Roman authorities. He operated mainly against the successive Western Roman regimes and marched into Italy, where he died. He is responsible for the sack of Rome in 410, one of several notable events in the Western Roman Empire's eventual decline. So it's the western part of the empire that is being attacked here. And by now you had two power centers. You had Rome and you also had Constantinople. And I think from this point on, the Eastern Roman Empire is referred to as the Byzantine Empire. But it actually means Eastern Roman Empire.
Hasn't that got more closer links to ancient Greece?
Yeah, that's Greek Orthodox. Yeah, Greek Orthodox Church. That's what you're thinking of there. And also using Greek as the language. And in the West, they use Latin as the common language. And it's called Byzantine because it comes from Byzantium, which was the Greek word for Constantinople, I think. Well, obviously named after Constantine the Great. And getting back to RW, go on.
I was just going to make a point that bringing it to some scriptures in the Bible where it talks about the gospel having been preached to, you know, the whole earth or world and under heaven. And I guess that under heaven where it had been preached was essentially, you know, the Byzantine Empire and the Roman Empire, you know, as a collective empire. So that was what was regarded as kind of, you know, heaven on earth, I guess, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the world. That was the known world. Outside of it was, they weren't a part of it. I think they might have even referred to it as the cosmos.
And really? And
you also get the Greek word for cosmos that's translated as world in...
They must have been aware of parts, though. Like, was Ethiopia, for example, part of the Byzantine Empire, being in the east?
I'm not sure that it was, or it might have been later on. I know that you have the Ethiopian Church, which is part of the Eastern Orthodox Church, but I'm not sure it was a part of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire had Northern Africa and also Egypt, and Ethiopia is at the bottom of Egypt. So I'm not sure, but obviously there was the Ethiopian Church, which became a part of the Eastern Orthodox Church, and there are... there are church fathers from the Eastern Orthodox Church from 500, 600 AD. I mean, that's quite an ancient church there. And obviously there were white people there at the time. We know, I think it's Herodotus was writing in 50 BC, and he's talking about people that are obviously white that are in the country or the territory that's now known as Ethiopia. And he also refers to savage tribes that weren't white, basically, and he gives a physical description of them, and it's obvious to tell that they're blacks that he's talking about, and they weren't a part of it. They were outside of it.
Yeah, I've heard that quote. Who was the historian again?
I think it was Herodotus.
Herodotus, yeah. Herodotus or Strabo, I think.
Either Strabo or Herodotus. If you want to find the details on that, you'll find it at Christiginia.org, and I think it's on the bit where William Fink is talking about chapter 10 from Genesis, and he goes into some of those details and how the word Ethiopian means shining face, sunburnt face. So the word itself, you know, describes white people. Mm-hmm. And it was originally called Cush, and obviously Cush was white. It was Noah's grandson was Cush. Getting back to R.W. Morgan here, talking about this movement of the nations. The numbers, which for the next century and a half continued to be disgorged by the wide regions of Northern Asia and Europe, upon the south and the west, almost exceed belief. So he's pointing out there Northern Asia. So you've got tribes coming in from Scythia as well, the Scythians and the Cimmerians. As an instance of the the Scythians and the Cimmerians had been coming in from about 500 BC. So they'd been coming in for about 1,000 years. But I guess you still had people that were coming in from Northern Asia as well at this time.
So they would have populated the portions of the nations which they're ransacking now, right?
Yeah, and also, I mean, the Scythians and the Cimmerians came in and they would have provided the basis for these Suevi and Vandals and Saxons and that's what they eventually became. If you think they came in into Europe about 1,000 years previous, obviously there were people in Europe before then, but not on any large scale. And then when they came in from the Near East, around about between, say, 500 BC and 1,000 500 BC and to the time of Christ, and then they were in the forests of Germany, and they were known as barbarians and fierce battle-hardened warriors, basically.
Yeah, I did. I was trying to explain to the wife the other day about the migrations and the population levels around 1000 AD were pretty much about 50 million. That's speculated in mainstream sources. So 50 million. And you think most of that would have been sort of the Mediterranean and kind of Mesopotamia area, because they were the largest civilizations, weren't they, where people would have been. And so Europe would have been more sparsely populated around that time. And so as the migrations happened, they just consumed and kind of overrun and absorbed, really. And where we are today, where we've got, you know, billions of, I don't know what the total number is for whites, but it's a lot higher. And so you can see really how through these migrations, the root seed of, you know, I guess Abraham from the or the tribes of Israel could become synonymous with Europe just through the absorption.
Just through the numbers, the numbers and their fecundity and the number of children that they would produce, and they would produce, split off and form various new tribes that would then become new nations, all working their way into Europe, migrating through from the Near East at different times. As an instance of the gigantic scale on which military operations during this period were conducted, at the Battle of Leon, AD 448, between Aetius and Attila the Hun, the forces engaged exceeded 800,000 men, of whom between 200,000 and 300,000 are computed to have fallen on the field. The most sanguinary engagements of modern ages appear in comparison to be mere skirmishes. I mean, that's almost a million men fighting. A few examples will illustrate the characters and institutions of some of the nations of the Black Invasion. The Huns, says Jornandes, the Gothic historian, put to flight by the terror inspired by their countenance, those whom their bravery could never have subdued. The livid colour of their face had something frightful in it. It was not a face, but a formless mass of flesh in which two black and sinister spots filled the place of eyes. Their aspects were not those of men, but of beasts, standing on their hind legs, as if it were in mockery of our species. An ordinary tax imposed by these brutal savages on the countries they overran was a certain number of young women, with a view to mitigate, if possible, the hideousness of their race. And you have to take that with a pinch of salt. Obviously, that's propaganda written by people that were against the Huns, because I do think the Huns were white. I don't think they would have been one of these other races. I don't think they were Arabs or anything like that. I mean, they eventually gave rise to Hungary, and the Hungarians are clearly white. So I think this is a case of propaganda trying to dehumanize the enemy, as it were. Next, we'll have a look at what Wikipedia has to say about Attila the Hun. Attila, frequently called Attila the Hun, was the ruler of the Huns from 434 until his death in March 453. He was also the leader of a tribal empire consisting of Huns, Ostrogoths, Alans, and Bulgars, among others, in Central and Eastern Europe. He is also considered to be one of the most powerful rulers in world history. So we can see there, if he was allied with the Ostrogoths, the Alans, and the Bulgars, the Huns were allied with them, they had to be of the same race. They couldn't have been of a different race mixed up amongst them. They had to have all been white people, basically. During his reign, he was one of the most feared enemies of the Western and Eastern Roman empires. He crossed the Danube twice and plundered the Balkans, but was unable to take Constantinople. His unsuccessful campaign in Persia was followed in 441 by an invasion of the Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire, the success of which emboldened Attila to invade the West. He also attempted to conquer Roman Gaul, modern France, crossing the Rhine in 451 and marching as far as Orellanium, or Orleans, before being stopped in the Battle of the Catalonian Plains. He subsequently invaded Italy, devastating the northern provinces, but was unable to take Rome. He planned for further campaigns, against the Romans, but died in 453. After Attila's death, his close advisor, Ardaric of the Gepids, led a Germanic revolt against Hunnic rule, after which the Hunnic Empire quickly collapsed, and Attila would live on as a character in Germanic heroic legend. And again, I don't think the Germans would hold the guy up to be this great hero if he hadn't been of Germanic heritage in the first place. You know, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I know there's a common misconception that the Huns were sort of Mongolian. I've got a Hungarian friend, and you know, he's not too sure. I know that there's kind of some bits of like more modern kind of illustrations would show more of a Mongolian, you know, kind of phenotype. But I think if you do look further into the past, that you do notice that they're actually more likely to be Caucasian and linked to, you know, descendant from the Scythian tribes, being nomadic.
Yeah, it's like Genghis Khan. If you look at the pictures of Genghis Khan that were drawn within 100 years of his life, you can see that he's white. If you look at the pictures of him today, they'll try and claim him to have been Mongolian. And I think another point that can be raised here is the rise and fall of kingdoms and empires. You think the Hungarians had a massive empire at this time, and now they've just got a fairly small country that isn't that important in Europe. You got the same with Lithuania, one of the smallest countries in Europe, and there was a Lithuanian empire at one time. They had a huge area of Europe that was ruled by Lithuania, and no more. They've just got this small little country. So there's a rise and a fall, or an ebb and a flow in the fortunes of some of these nations.
Yeah. I mean, even Romania, when you look at Bucharest, yeah, and some of the just the architecture, it's just staggering. Some of the finest in all of Europe. And, you know, it just attributes to its power at the time. But now, in terms of a powerful nation within Europe, it's kind of a shadow of itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems to be like that with a lot of the Balkan countries, the Balkan nations. I mean, Serbia was also very important at this time with the Romans. Well, next we'll look at the Germans, R.W. Morgan again. The Thuringian Germans, states Gibbon, massacred their hostages as well as their captives. 200 young maidens were tortured with exquisite cruelty, their bodies torn asunder by wild horses, or their bones crushed under the weight of rolling wagons, and their unburied limbs abandoned in the public roads as a prey to dogs and vultures. The kings of the German tribes, writes Sismondi, were only conspicuous by their crimes and vices. They were above the law, and it would be difficult to find in any class of men, even among those whom public justice has consigned to the hulks and galleys, so many examples of atrocious crimes, assassinations, poisonings, and above all fratricides as these royal families afforded during the 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries. And we do tend to romanticize the Saxons, but we'll actually see when they come to Britain that you know, they really couldn't be trusted. And I guess if you think, well, they go back to these Scythians, and they'd lost their own country, they'd lost their own civilization, they really didn't have much choice but to become barbarian-like, but to become like robbers, basically. And that's, I guess, gave rise to the Vikings and the Viking raids on Britain and the rest of it. Yet they still had that ability for civilization there. And once they had settled down, I mean, we had some wonderful things that were created by them by the time we get to Alfred the Great. But at this period, it's when Dr. E. Michael Jones talks about them hunting pigs in the woods and not doing much else. Well, that's because that's what they were. They were robbers. They were vagabonds, but they were also incredible fighters, absolutely incredible fighters. And the Romans would hire them in battle along with the Britons.
Do you think it's the case that by this time much of Europe was kind of starting to really be established, and they, you know, there was no kind of plain land for them to, or the best land was taken, basically, the most fertile land, and, you know, for them to thrive, and it would have been hard to settle elsewhere. So they kind of had to try and get in muscle in on other people's lands.
They were in Germany, weren't they? They were in the forests of Germany, so they just really had forests, I guess. They didn't have the resources there. They didn't have tin like you had in Britain. They didn't have ports. They weren't by the sea, so they just had forests, which is where they were. Mm. And in Rome, you had the civilization there. And they'd lost their civilization. That they'd had their country taken from them when they were in Israel and Judah, and then they were removed up to Assyria, and then they made their way across from the Euphrates and into Europe, traveling along the way with their wagons. And I guess then they settled in Germany, and once they settled in Germany, like increased. And as I say, they were hired out as hired warriors and mercenaries, because they were great fighters, which they would have grown to be, having to survive on their wits alone. Mm. But it also meant that they couldn't really be trusted.
Yeah, and I read before Truthvids in one of his videos mentioned about the root word of the Saxons being, sons of Isaac. Do you think there's kind of truth to that?
Saxon, Saxon. I think the word Saxon comes from Scythian, and Scythian. The ISK, Isaac at the beginning of it, and the tribes are called the Ascusa. So yeah, there is that to it, and the reason why they were called German, because they were the Scythians when they came in. They were referred to as the Scythians. Where they'd come from was Scythia, and as they made their way into Europe, they started being called Germain, which means genuine, meaning they were the genuine Scythians, because you had the Sarmatians moved into Scythia after they moved out of Scythia. You had Sarmatians in there, and they weren't Scythians. But the ones that came into Europe were actually Scythians, so then they started being referred to as German or Germain. And that's why in the oldest British histories, when they talk about the Saxons coming over, they say the Saxons came over from Scythia. And people today will look at that and they'll say, well, what idiots these British historians were. Didn't they know that Scythia was up near Persia? But in actual fact, no, they were referring to it as Scythia because they knew that the Saxons themselves that were coming were originated in the Scythians. So they called the country that they were in, they call it Scythia. So Saxon, Scythian, German, they're all the same people. And before that, I mean, the Cimmerians as well were the same people, part of originally. The Scythians and the Cimmerians were one people, but they ended up splitting up and becoming two different peoples and fighting amongst one another and splitting up even more into, like the Cimmerians ended up being the Danes, the Normans, the Britons, and the Saxons ended up being the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes, probably the Vandals. The Gauls. Yeah, the Gauls, the rest of them. And that's where they all originated from. The German nations whom they ruled were accustomed to consider their kings as a race apart, distinguished from themselves by their long hair, a race not subject to the same laws nor moved by the same feelings. These kings, keeping themselves aloof from all other men, were singular in having family names and in intermarrying with each other, and we owe to them the introduction of relationship between crowned heads, which was before unknown in the world. And I'm not sure that was unknown in the world, because we do know that these Hittite princesses would be married off to the Egyptian pharaohs, but I guess that's something different. That's a diplomatic thing, like a foreign diplomacy thing. What he's talking about here is the intermarriage that we see between the heads of the nations of Europe. So there was this royalty, this royal race that would only intermarry with one another. And that really sort of points back to this Israelite thing as well, doesn't it? That they should only marry somebody from the tribe of Judah or from the house of David, tying in with what we were talking about in the Jeremiah episode. So again, you've got a pointer that's who these people are. That's who their royal line is. Then from Clovis to Charles Martel, the grandfather of Charlemagne, states Ira Crowe, the last English historian of France, there existed not a personage worthy of the reader's attention. There is not recorded an event or an anecdote which would excite any feeling but disgust. This observation will apply with nearly equal force to all the Saxon kings before Alfred. These and the rest of the invading nations continued to be pagans long after they had quartered amongst them the conquered provinces. And obviously there's this look at the pagans as being degenerate, basically. While Rome had become Christian by this point, Britain was Christian, the civilized areas were Christian, and outside the civilized areas were pagan. So he's not very flattering about these German kings. As I say, this is a patriotic history. R.W. Morgan is a patriotic historian, and this was just common at the time. You think 170 years ago, people were extremely patriotic, and the way that history was told was in a patriotic way, or maybe you could say in a chauvinistic way. You know, not looking at the positive points. And this has always gone on. I mean, when the Saxons came into Britain, you had Bede that wrote about the Britons, and he certainly wasn't flattering about the Britons. I mean, he saw it as his role was to run them down and to justify the Saxons taking over the country, basically. And you had the same with the Romans when they were writing about the Huns, saying that they were just like animals and what have you. So I dare say some of that plays into these reports about these kings. But at the same time, I mean, these are German historians, Saxon historians, the last English historian of France that is actually saying this about these tribes, because the Franks were the same as the Saxons originally. Mm. We brought up Clovis there. Clovis was the first king of the Franks to unite all of the Frankish tribes under one ruler, changing the form of leadership from a group of petty kings to rule by a single king and ensuring that the kingship was passed down to his heirs. He is considered to have been the founder of the Merovingian dynasty, which ruled the Frankish kingdom for the next two centuries. Clovis is important in the historiography of France as the first king of what would become France. Clovis is also significant due to his conversion to Catholicism in 496, largely at the behest of his wife Clotilda, who would later be venerated as a saint for this act, celebrated today in both the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church. And of course, they're both the same thing at this time, 496. We didn't really get the Roman Catholic Church until the schism in 1060, which resulted in the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, back at this time, it was the Catholic Church. Clovis was baptized on Christmas Day in 508. The adoption by Clovis of Catholicism, as opposed to the Arianism of most other Germanic tribes, led to widespread conversion among the Frankish peoples and to religious unification across what is now a modern-day France, the Low Countries, and Germany. Three centuries later, it led to Charlemagne's alliance with the Bishop of Rome, and in the middle of the 10th century, under Otto I the Great, to the consequent birth of the early Holy Roman Empire. So that's why he's important. You can trace it back to Clovis. You can trace Christianity back to Clovis. And then from Clovis, you get all the other Frankish people becoming Christian. And eventually you get the start of the Holy Roman Empire, which would have been the First Reich, is what that would have been called. Got any comments on that, Patriarch?
Just really on the... The church as a whole, that it was the main organized church, wasn't it, throughout the Roman and Byzantine Empire? Was it? How different were the practices? Do you know between when it was called the Roman Catholic Church and just the general church?
Well, when you get to the Roman Catholic Church and Eastern Orthodox, then they differed over the importance of the Pope. But back at this time, what Catholic meant was universal. So it meant that everybody that was part of the Catholic Church followed the same Bible, the same doctrines. And that's what it meant by universal. It meant that universally they had the same doctrine. But what you also had at this time was Arianism, which was a heresy, and you had Pelagianism as well, which was another heresy. So you had these different ideas of what Christianity should be that were then put down by the Catholics, by this central idea of what Christianity should be. that came
and so
out.
What was, so what was Arianism professing then? Was it a branch of Christianity or just a pagan?
It was a version of Christianity. It was a heretical version of Christianity. I couldn't tell you exactly what the differences were. There were some things like not believing that Jesus was actually God, that he was a man.
Okay.
You know, that sort of thing was the main differences, or not using certain books of the Bible, not using all of them. And that's what they meant by Catholic, universal. Everybody who is Catholic uses and follows the same doctrine, uses the same books of the Bible, and you will hear the same thing being preached in Constantinople as you would also hear in, I don't know, Reims or one of these other cities in Europe.
So the initial name of the Catholic Church was to unify essentially the beliefs, belief systems and set of doctrines through, a common source, like a common thread. And it's nothing to do with the universal being universal to anybody, any people.
Yeah, basically. That's correct. That's correct. And these things were decided in various councils that took place, like the Council of Nicaea. And I think Constantine was the first one to call one of these councils and to say, look, we've got to get everything standardized here. Now that this is going to be the religion of the empire, it has to be standardized so that throughout the empire, everybody is following the same thing. And then you had these various heresies that would pop up. The old Celto-Roman population was reduced to serfdom. The heads of the barbarian clans became kings by, as it was afterwards impiously termed, divine right. The inferior chiefs became barons, or owners of the land, and its serfs. The Roman civil law, by which the continent had been ruled, was abolished, and the feudal system was at first rudely, but afterwards systematically, imposed. The feudal system regarded the people as an inferior species of mankind to those kings and chiefs who traced their descent to Balti or Odin, the pagan gods or idols, and who, in right of it, claimed exemption from all human laws and responsibility. So you had two classes of citizen here. I think this ties in with the Welsh as well. It's like the Welsh used to mean slave, didn't it? And the Saxons used to use the Welsh as slaves. So these Germanic tribes would use the people that they conquered, they would use them as slaves, and they would see them as being owned by the baron or whoever it was that owned the land. And I guess this divine right, I mean, that could go back to the divine right of kings going back to Judah. And his line was kingly. And I guess by this time they were tracing it back to Odin, and hopefully we're going to hear some more about Odin, the actual king, from Truthvids. He's going to be joining us in the next couple of weeks to talk to us about that. But that was what they claimed gave them this right to rule, was their descendancy from Odin.
And when they talk about kind of pure descent, do you think that might be kind of in keeping with the, you know, sort of pure lineage back to Judah or Abraham, that the other lesser peoples or more common peoples would have just intermixed with the likes of Japhethite, who was kind of amongst the first to sparsely populate Europe. Do you think they kind of looked down on that, even if they're in of the same general race? They're still not a pure line.
Could well do. If they would have to trace themselves back 10 generations. If they could prove that they had this, they could trace themselves back that far, then that shows they have this lineage. And I think they'd forgotten or were unaware that the people that they were ruling were originally the same as them. But they were just people that had come into Europe earlier than them. And that was the only difference. Right. That they just arrived here before them. To this system of mingled heathenism, brute force, and servility, the Briton of these islands never ceased to present a front of scorn and hostility. Hence the deadly and protracted nature of the wars which ensued between him and the German or serf nations with whom it originated. Of all the nations, however, whom the carcass of the great empire allured from their lagoons and forests, overtowering the rest as a species by himself, stood forth the Saxon of the seas. His name among the non-marine populations of the continent inspired inexpressible terror. Of fabulous attachment to the wave and the storm, rioting in the undisputed possession of the ocean, their very religion, combat and havoc, the Saxons had established a prestige above Goth, Vandal or Hun for cruelty and insensibility to danger. Of apparent ubiquity, formidable alike from their innate solidity, their effective arms, their habit of closing in dense columns with their enemies, their invasion might have shaken the framework of the Roman Empire in its zenith. So the Saxons were really feared. They were the top tribe, and they were known for their marine skills. So The Saxon Confederation, extending from the mouths of the Rhine to the lower Baltic, consisted of various tribes of Gothic extraction, the principal of which were the Saxons or the Sacers, the Jutes, the Getae, and the Angles, occupying the territory south and southwest of the Cymric Chersonese, and that's Denmark. So the old name for Denmark was the Cymric Chersonese. The Danes traced themselves back to the Cimmerians. The Cimmerians is where the Cymry come from, where the Welsh come from. So the Danes themselves were the same people as the Cymry originally. The Chersonese itself was peopled by the descendants of the ancient Cymry, between whom and the Saxons a mortal antagonism prevailed. And that goes back to the Cimmerians fighting against the Scythians. Uniting with the Scandinavian tribes of Hlochlin or Norway, these became the Danes and the Normans of the 9th, 10th and 11th centuries, carrying with them wherever they went their old hatred of their Saxon neighbours. And of course, when the Normans came in, they turned the Saxons into slaves, and they banned the Saxon language because the Normans go back to the Cymry as well. So you can see there's always been this fighting between Cimmerians and Scythians under whatever names that they actually have. R.W. Morgan wasn't aware of the fact that the Scythians and the Cimmerians were originally the same. That information came about from the translation of the Behistun Rock, which I'm not sure was actually carried out at the time when R.W. Morgan was alive. So that's more recent information that tells us that. Because on the Behistun Rock, it tells us that in one of the languages, it says Cymry, that became the Cimmerians, and in another language, it says Scythian, that became the Saxons. So it's the same word for both of them.
And Cymry comes from Gomri, isn't it? It was one of the kings of Israel at the time.
Yeah, King Omri, a very, very, very famous king that gave rise to a big lineage, was called Omri. So the Assyrian pronunciation of it was Gomri, because they put a G-H before the O. Or that was the original way it was pronounced. And when we had our Bibles translated, they just called him Omri, but it was actually Gomri. And that's where this word Cymry comes from. And then that becomes Latinized as Cimmerian. Well, the Saxon Confederation diverged into two branches, one striking inwards, extending its acquisitions so far that Eginhard, the secretary of Charlemagne, states that in AD 800 they constituted more than one half of Germany. This was continental Saxondom. It was subdued and added to the Franco-German Empire by Charlemagne, with its Saxon population being nearly exterminated. The other threw itself in a succession of invasions from AD 420 to AD 580 onto the British island, rested 220 years after its first landing, i.e. in the 6th generation, the Pendragonate or military supremacy from the Cymry, and fusing with the British Hlogrians and Corinaiad, became the main stock of the modern English. Their sovereignty gave way AD 1014 temporarily to the Danish and permanently to the Norman AD 1066, as the Norman gave way in turn to the native British, restored in AD 1485. And I think that was the Tudors, because the Tudors had a closer link to the actual Cymry in Britain rather than the Normans. But the Normans originally went back to the the Cymry anyway. So that what it's saying here, the Saxons basically took over that role that the Cymry had of the Pendragonate being the whole rulers of the island, and then they fused with the Logrians and the Corinaiad, and that became the English. And I'm wondering about when Charlemagne put down the Saxon population, maybe that was this famous bit that the pagans like to bring up of this massacre of the pagans that Charlemagne carried out, which was basically a one tribe that was refusing to submit to his rule. So he had them massacred and destroyed all their sacred groves, Charlemagne did. And pagans like to bring that
up. Where's the Angles? Do they come in a little bit later?
Well, it mentions them here. The Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, or the Getae.
Right, because they became kind of intertwined as a culture, didn't they? The Anglo-Saxons. It's almost like a double-barreled culture.
Yeah, and I don't think the Angles were that important, really. It's just that's what we called them. We mix them both in together. It says here they occupied the territory south and southwest of Denmark. So they would have been... And also, obviously, northern Germany. So that's the area that they would have come from in their battleships. To explain the origin of the Saxons, the most absurd fictions have been invented. No mention of them occurs in history until AD 140. Tacitus, in AD 80, does not even name them in his Germania. From AD 141 to AD 260, no one again mentions them. AD 280, they were taken into service by Carausius, the British emperor, trained by British officers to naval manoeuvres, and incorporated with the British Empire. In AD 347, they were again in league with Magnentius, another British emperor. So that's interesting. So they actually learnt their naval skills from British officers. And where it says that nobody had actually heard of them, that's because the name evolved from Scythian, and it evolved into Saxon. Some of these Scythian tribes, I think, were called Saxon, Saxomuni. And you had Eastern Saxons and Western Saxons, and the Eastern Saxons gave rise to Buddha. I think we talked about that earlier on in the series, about how Buddha came from these Scythian tribes. There's a book about the Eastern Saxons and the Western Saxons and how they came from the Scythians. So that's why R.W. Morgan is saying, you know, we just don't know where these guys came from, because he hasn't worked out the fact that the name evolved from the Scythians, and that's originally where they came from. So the people that were in Germany, they weren't the Scythians, they weren't the Saxons. They were there probably really weren't that many people there until this migration that came in from 500 BC up until the time of Christ, and right about that time.
Yeah, and it kind of fits. How long were they in Assyrian captivity for? Say you know, assuming the narrative, you know, Northern Kingdom of Israel being taken captive and then used as a shield wall against Assyria to fend off any invaders. And so how long were they kind of populating the outskirts before becoming nomadic?
About 100 years, I think. I think they're there for about 100 years.
So that fits
years.
About the timeline, doesn't it, really?
Yeah. I think it was 7-something when the Israelites were deported, and 5-something when the Judahites were deported, or maybe I think it's about 100-150 years between the two, and then you get the books of Jeremiah being written, and then you get the book of Esdras, which says that they decided to go up through the Euphrates and find new lands. So that tells us when they left. They must have left at the time that Esdras was writing, which I think is probably about 400 BC. I mean, you'd have to look into it to see when it was that they think Esdras was writing. But that was the time, because he didn't know what happened to them after that. And then you get Flavius Josephus, which just says that they're all beyond the Euphrates, and the number is like, you know, you can't. It's just too many of them to actually make an estimate of the number. So you literally have millions of them in Europe. So getting back to the Saxons, from this period, their power steadily increased. New tribes, the Chalci, the Camavi, Fusi, Batavi, Toxandri, and Marini, joining the Confederacy, which in AD 400 embraced all northern Germany from the Rhine to Lithuania and the Baltic. In AD 368, in conjunction with the Picts, they invaded Kent, slew Nectarides and Fulafaudes, the Roman counts, and made an attempt on London, but they were defeated by Theodosius. In AD 369, they were again defeated by the British fleets under Theodosius in three naval engagements off the Humber, in the Forth, and at the Orkneys. So that's the Emperor Theodosius. So Rome has still got an interest in Britain at this time. On intelligence of these disasters reaching the Confederation, it poured its forces against the Roman legions on the Rhine. The Roman general fell back until reinforced when an armistice was concluded, the Saxons giving up 10,000 of their ablest young men to recruit the imperial armies. The rest were to retire unmolested, but on their retreat they were treacherously ambushed and, after a brave resistance, slaughtered by the Roman troops. So the Roman troops stabbed them in the back this time. In AD 396, they were again defeated by Stilicho, and in AD 410, they formed a league with the Bretons of Armorica against Euric the Goth, and ravaged France, Belgium, Italy, Spain, and Germany. AD 425, in league with the Picts, they were defeated by St. Germanus on the Hallelujah Field near Mold, and Mold is in North Wales. In AD 449, they connect themselves permanently with British history by the landing of Hengist and Horsa at the invitation of Vortigern on the Kentish island of Thanet. And that's the famous landing of the Saxons. So what we're learning here is that there had been battles with the Saxons before them, and because we defeated them, they then went in and tried to attack Rome, because it was Rome that was actually helping us to defend Britain from these Saxons. Do you want to add anything to that, Patriarch?
No, I can't think. The Picts, I know they were the more natives, and they had a very colourful attire. I know that much, as a distinct tribe, but they were pretty much, absorbed or wiped out, weren't they?
Well, the Picts, I think it goes back to pictogram, and they were painted. They would wear tattoos and ink. Mm. And they were up in Scotland, and we will hear more about them, because they were used as the excuse to invite the Saxons to come over. But I found this mention of this character here, Saint Germanus, I found rather interesting, because he is spoken of here as leading an army against the Saxons, and you don't often hear of saints who were great warriors. And this also took place in Mold, in Northern Wales. So we'll have a closer look at St. Germanus. This is what Wiki has to say about him. Germanus of Auxerre was a Western Roman clergyman who was the bishop of Auxerre in late antique Gaul. He abandoned a career as a high-ranking government official to devote his formidable energy towards the promotion of the church and the protection of his flock in dangerous times, personally confronting, for instance, the barbarian king Guar, leader of the Alans. In Britain, he is best remembered for his journey to combat Pelagianism in or around 429 AD, and the records of this visit provide valuable information on the state of post-Roman British society. He also played an important part in the establishment and promotion of the cult of St. Alban, and I think St. Alban was martyred by Diocletian around about the time of St. George and Constantine. Just before Constantine the Great, there was a great persecution of Christians, and I forget how many, I think it was 2,000 and something odd marches there were in Britain, and one of them was this St. Alban, who gave his name to St. Albans. So it was thanks to St. Germanus that we remember St. Alban. The saint was said to have revealed the story of his martyrdom to Germanus in a dream or holy vision, and Germanus ordered this to be written down for public display. Germanus is venerated as a saint in both the Roman Catholic and the Orthodox churches, which commemorate him on the 31st of July. Around 429, shortly after the Romans had withdrawn from Britain, a Gaulish assembly of bishops chose Germanus and Lupus, the bishop of Troy, to visit the island. It was alleged that Pelagianism was rife among the British clergy, led by a British bishop's son named Agricola. Germanus went to combat the threat and to satisfy the Pope that the British church would not break away from the Augustinian teachings of divine grace. On the way to Britain, they passed through Nanterre, where Germanus noticed in the crowd which met them a young girl whom he bade to live as one espoused to Christ and who later became St. Genevieve of Paris. Germanus and Lupus confronted the British clergy at a public meeting before a huge crowd in Britain. The Pelagians were described as being conspicuous for their riches, brilliant in dress, and surrounded by a fawning multitude. The bishops debated, and despite having no popular support, Germanus was able to defeat the Pelagians using his superior rhetorical skills. Germanus then led the native Britons to a victory against Pictish and Saxon raiders at a mountainous site near a river, of which Mold in North Wales is the traditional location. The enemy approaching, the former general put himself at the head of the Christians. He led them into a vale between two high mountains and ordered his troops to shout when he gave them a sign. When the Saxon pirates came near them, he cried out thrice, "Alleluia," which was followed by the whole army of the Britons. The sound echoed from the hills with a noise so loud that the barbarians, judging from the shout that they were facing a mighty army, flung down their arms and ran away, leaving behind their baggage and their booty. And there are a lot of references to St. Germanus, so it does sound likely that this story actually happened, because there are so many references to him by these historians. So we have quite a bit of detail there about this heresy that was going on in Britain and how the heretics were all dressed in fine clothes, where they'd obviously made a lot of money out of the people that had been following them. So it's rather similar to today, isn't it?
Yeah, that divide. Yes, definitely echoes.
Following the easy path rather than entering through the straight gate.
Yeah. So Saint, would you say it was a religious crusade then as well, with him being Saint, being kind of given the name Saint Germanus? Do you think he was trying to clean up places?
Well, he was a very holy man, and he was sent there to stamp out the heresy, which he did by debate, and then he also defeated this army by shouting hallelujah and it echoing through the cliffs. So I should imagine that's the reason why he was sainted. We now resume the thread of British history at the election of Constantine, the Prince of Armorica, to the throne in AD 406. The news of the fall of Gaul reached Britain early in the spring of the following year. The restoration of British independency had been effected with little or no hostile feeling towards the old empire. A considerable Roman element pervaded the population. Many of the leading nobility were of Brito-Roman blood, and could not, without emotion, survey the ruin spread over the fairest portion of the continent by the heathen hordes. Constantine was called upon to lead the British army to the deliverance of Gaul. He landed at Boulogne, June AD 407, defeated the Suevi at Amiens, advanced to Paris, and there received the submission of all Gaul north of the Loire. So again, we have a British king here, and he was also the Prince of Armorica. So you can see that the British royal family had various parts of Europe that they were also responsible for. I think Armorica is Brittany, is known as Brittany now. And he's also got the same name as Constantine the Great, and he's also one of Constantine the Great's later descendants. And because we have all these different people that are called Constantine, some of the things that this Constantine did get mixed up with the things that Constantine the Great did, because there was also a Constantine the Tyrant at one point. So when people say Constantine the Great was evil, or he was wicked and he did this, that, or the other, it's usually meaning Constantine the Tyrant. Or perhaps it could be meaning this Constantine.
Yeah, I think the name is derived from Latin. Apparently it's constant or steadfast. constant and steadfast.
Yeah, they all had names with meaning. In the south, two reverses were experienced. One of his generals, Estin, falling by treachery. Another, Nevergastes, in the field, AD 408, August 23rd. Stilicho, with the exception of Aetius and Belisarius, the last great champion of Rome, was assassinated by Cyrus at the instigation of the base emperor, Honorius. He had shortly before earnestly advised the Senate to secure for the empire the services of Alaric the Goth at an annual payment of £4,000 weight of gold. The advice was taken, and Alaric was ordered to march against Constantine, now proclaimed the Emperor of the West, instead of which, on hearing of the death of Stilicho, he moved upon Rome. He was then brought off by an enormous ransom and retired at the head of 100,000 men and 40,000 liberated slaves to Lombardy. So this is where, again, where you hear about the barbarians being paid off. Alaric was supposed to march against Constantine, who is now not only taken over Gaul, but he's now pronounced himself the emperor of the Western Empire. So
I guess that wasn't by vote like then.
No. Cyrus, meanwhile, having been defeated by Constantine at Vienna, Spain and the Honorian cohorts declared in favour of the British king, who thus reigned without a rival from the Hebrides to Gibraltar, not only the old Roman populations, but over the recent barbarian conquerors themselves. Honorius now recognised him as Augustus, divided the Western Empire with him, and requested his aid to repel Alaric's second meditated attack upon Rome. Constantine crossed the Alps. At his approach, the Goth withdrew into Germany. The two emperors held a conference at Milan, after which Constantine returned to Gaul. One branch of the ancient British dynasty, the family of Constantine the Great, had now for a century governed the Eastern Empire. Nor did it pass from the sway of their posterity for another 1,000 years until AD 1465. Another branch, had Constantine used his fortune with moderation, might have handed down the throne of the West to their remote descendants, dividing thus the old Roman world between them. So you can see that, you know, the British were very important here. It was the British kings that were ruling, that they were the emperors over the whole of the Roman Empire. Going back to Constantine the Great. In AD 410, Constantine was so ill-advised as to supersede his able general, Geraint, the Duke of Cornwall, whom he had appointed regent of Spain, by his son Constance. Alaric, about the same time, capturing Rome on August 24th and abandoning it for 3 days to the fury of his barbarians. Geraint, rebelling, crossed the Pyrenees, met Constantine and Constantius, the general of Honorius, at Ares, and being defeated, put an end to his own existence. The flower of the British legions perished in this battle. A fresh rupture ensuing with Honorius, Constantine was defeated by Constantius and Ulfilas and secretly put to death with Julian, his eldest son, on November the 11th, 411. So he shouldn't have promoted his son. He should have kept Geraint in that position, rather than promoting his son, and eventually he was secretly put to death.
Any thoughts? The end of his line, then, I guess.
I think he actually had two other sons. Which we will get into next week. Since we started this, we better just say what Wikipedia has to say about this Constantine. He's known as Constantine III, the Western Roman Emperor. Constantine III died shortly before 18th of September 411. He was a Roman general who declared himself Western Roman Emperor in Britannia in 407 and established himself in Gaul. He was co-emperor from 409 until 411. Constantine rose to power during a bloody struggle in Roman Britain and was acclaimed emperor by the local legions in 407. He promptly moved to Gaul, taking all of the mobile troops from Britain to confront the various Germanic invaders who had crossed the Rhine the previous winter. Constantine gained the upper hand after several battles with the forces of the Western Roman Emperor Honorius. As a result, Honorius recognised Constantine as co-emperor in 409. The activities of the invading tribes raids by Saxons on the now near defenceless Britain, and desertions by some of his top commanders led to a collapse of support. After further military setbacks, he abdicated in 411 and was captured and executed shortly afterwards. So we see here that exactly the same as with Constantine the Great. I mean, he was acclaimed emperor by the local legions in Britain, and he was a British king. You got the same thing happening here. You've got a British king, and he's being acclaimed emperor in Britain. So Britain was very important to the Roman Empire. It wasn't this backwater. And he was known as Constantine III there, but he's also known as Constantine II of Britain. Constantine III is also known as Constantine II of Britain. He bears some relation to the Constantine found in Geoffrey of Monmouth's highly popular and imaginative Historia Regum Britanniae, who comes to power following Gracchus Municep's reign. In Geoffrey's account, the Britons ask Aldronius, the ruler of Armorica, to be their ruler after the Roman withdrawal, seeking a king who can defend them against the barbarians. Aldronius refuses, believing the country to have diminished, but he sends his brother Constantine to rule instead. Constantine becomes king and has three sons, Constans, Aurelius, and Uther, but he is stabbed to death by a Pict. So you hear there about these other two sons, Aurelius and Uther, and Uther actually becomes the father of Arthur. The Constantine described in Geoffrey's account is loosely based on Constantine III, although he gives him a different family background. Geoffrey's Constantine is the brother of Aldronius, both of whom were the descendants of Conan Maradioc. It is Geoffrey's Constantine who, through his son Uther Pendragon, becomes the grandfather of the legendary King Arthur. Some other sources explicitly state that Constantine III is the grandfather of Arthur. Notably, the Welsh Triad number 51 describes Arthur's grandfather to be Custain the Blessed, and goes on to say that Bran, son of Dufanol, and Custain, son of Ellen, had been emperors in Rome. So that's the supporting evidence for this. Geoffrey of Monmouth, where did Geoffrey of Monmouth get it from? He got it from the Welsh histories. And you can also see it from the Welsh kingly lines, the family trees that have been traced, that I forget who it was. There was a king, I think, in the 5th century, and he wrote down all the family tree. And that's and it's in there as well. I'm annoyed. I can't remember the actual name of what it's referred to as.
So looking back, you know, the history that Rome has with Britain, we have sort of three ongoing wars which lasted a very long time, at which point Britain was kind of renowned for its tin trade and very wealthy in minerals and whatnot. And then so it finally succumbs to the Roman Empire, and it becomes almost adopted as the new kind of capital, almost, doesn't it? It seems, you know, yeah,
Yeah, probably a good way of looking at it. I mean, you refer to the three battles there. I mean, I think it was the two with Caesar, the fairly short ones with Julius Caesar, where he was beaten both times. And then there was that really long 40-year-long war that they had against the Romans, which started off with Claudius. And then at the end of that, they came to an agreement that the Britons would keep their kings, and they would keep their laws, and they would pay the tribute, and they would provide soldiers for the army. And then what happened was the Roman emperors then came to Britain and they intermarried with the British royalty, because the British royalty went back to Brutus, and the aristocracy of Rome also went back to Aeneas. Aeneas was Brutus's grandfather, and the royalty of Rome went back to, or the aristocracy of Rome went back to Aeneas. So when they wanted to marry somebody that was of the same aristocratic standing, they would marry one of the princesses of the British kings. Or and vice versa, I should imagine, which meant that the descendant would then become a British king, and they would also then have access to becoming the Emperor of Rome, which is why we've had, I mean, what did it say here? Three emperors of Rome were British kings, descended from British kings. So that's why you have this that's why you have this link there, and that's a link that most British people are completely unaware of, that these emperors of Rome were British, and you know, they used to live in Britain. And as it says here, you know, the emperor was proclaimed within Britain by these troops. And I mean, they might say, oh, he was proclaimed in Britain by the Roman troops, but the Roman troops were all British. That was part of the deal that we did with the Romans. So a lot of the troops were British.
So around this time then, how were the power structures looking in the city of Rome, and you know where the Caesars and whatnot used to rule from? Do you know much about what was going on in the same kind of timeline? Because there's obviously still the Roman Empire, but it was just the Western Rome side of Rome, and then there was the Eastern side of Rome.
Yeah, and it was very weak. You had an emperor of the West and you had an emperor of the East, and the emperor of the East ruled over the West as well at some time. But they were beginning to get extremely weak, and they were having to pay all their wealth to these barbarians to stop the barbarians from invading. As you see with Alaric the Goth here. I mean, how much he gets paid? He gets paid loads of gold to fight off the Britons or fight off the Saxons, and instead he goes straight for Rome and says, you know, well, now you've got to give me even more money. Yeah, here it is, 4,000. It was supposed to get 4,000 pounds weight of gold, and that was to march against Constantine, the British king, who had proclaimed himself Emperor of the West. But instead of that, when he heard that Stilicho had died, he moved upon Rome. And then he was bought off at a huge ransom in Rome. And you think 4,000 pounds weight of gold? I mean, what's that? 4 tons of gold?
That's a lot.
And that was an annual payment he was supposed to be paid. And then he went after Rome anyway, instead of going after the Britons. So, you know, the Britons must have been quite a formidable force if Rome was prepared to pay all that amount of gold just to get someone to fight against them. And it also shows that the Romans themselves, you know, they couldn't provide that manpower.
There was mention of the Thanet earlier, wasn't there? I forget where.
Yeah, the Isle of Thanet.
I was going to ask. The Isle of Thanet, yeah. So that came up again, and there were a lot of battles that took place there, weren't there, in the past? So there's a lot of history there.
Yeah, that's where, I think that's where Julius Caesar arrived.
Yeah.
Julius Caesar on his second excursion into Britain. He was allowed to land at the Isle of Thanet because in the first instance, we defeated him on the beach and he didn't get any further up the beach. And the traitor, Mandubratius, or one of his descendants, said, well, that's not very manly of us to fight them on the beaches. They could say that it was that which led to them losing. So this time we'll have to actually let them in. We'll have to invite them in. And once they had invited the Romans in and the Romans had come in, then this Mandubratius became a traitor, and all of his tribe fought on the side of the Romans. So that was his trick. But yeah, that was the Isle of Thanet. And what happens now, the mention of Isle of Thanet here, is that's where Hengist and Horsa landed, is on the Isle of Thanet. And we'll hear more about Hengist and Horsa in the next episode. But yeah, the Isle of Thanet is quite a famous historical place.
A lot of history that I'd never heard of it before we started this podcast, and it's got a lot of kind of real history and kind of you know, it's kind of a significant part where you know, what battles took place, and it'll be interesting to go, actually. There must be some infrastructure and that still standing, which will shed more insight into what went off there.
Yeah, it's fascinating finding out about all these places in Britain and the history behind them. And I think Nigel Farage stood for a Member of Parliament on the Isle of Thanet for UKIP, or somebody from UKIP that was representing the Isle of Thanet got into Parliament. I think it was Nigel Farage that stood for the Isle of Thanet. I think that's where I first heard of it. And then you find out about it in these histories. But yeah, I think we should leave that here for today then, Patriarch. So thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome. Thanks for the podcast and information, as always.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.